If you're hearing a wobble or a whine where there should be a hum, our next guest has heard many of these over the years. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive. He's our partner in a monthly segment we call the Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Make some noise and get some attention from Zach as a result. Call or email again, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. This month, fun with your cooling system and how hard it has to work, and of course particularly harder when we start seeing the temperatures climb into the triple digits. You had alluded to this in some previous conversations. I mean, the cooling system is going to come up, but I mean, things get really hot in there, don't they?
They do, yeah, very hot, to the point where metal can melt.
We were talking about this, having some discussions back and forth in email beforehand. I referred to them as explosions. You prefer to, the term controlled burns about what's going on in the cylinders of your car. But we are talking something burning at a high temperature to force the expansion of gases that push a piston down.
Yeah, so it's an ignition of the air-fuel mixture, and that is technically a controlled burn. I remember it in school. You know, a lot of us, when we were kids, we wanted to refer to that as an explosion, and we were always corrected. You know, it's not an explosion, it's a controlled burn. And but yeah, there's combustion chamber temperatures, you know, that are in the thousands of degrees. And, you know, oxides and nitrogen, which is a gas that is controlled and not wanted, they occur at temperatures above 2,500 degrees, and that's when you'll hear pinging happening. If you hear your car start to ping, it kind of sounds like marbles in a can, mm-hmm. or like a little bit like a diesel engine. Those are a pre-ignition that's happening when you have two flame fronts colliding in the combustion chamber, mm-hmm. and it makes that unique noise. And so at that point, you know you've exceeded temperatures at 2,500 degrees, which is very hot. So the cooling system is a critical component of your vehicle. And as technology advances, cooling systems are becoming increasingly complex.
So the basic gist of it, though, is that if you have a liquid-cooled engine, the liquid more or less surrounds the cylinder to carry the heat off. But then you have to have the liquid has to continue to circulate that it can get to the radiator and
yeah.
get cooled off.
I like to tell people, think about it like if you were running a fever and you get into an ice bath. So you would be, your body would be the cylinders, and the ice bath would be the water jackets. They're called water jackets that surround all the cylinders in an engine. So if you have a four-cylinder or a V6, you know, you've got water being pumped around four or six-cylinder walls, and that water, which is actually an antifreeze mixture of ethylene glycol and water, that water serves to absorb the heat created by the friction of internal rotating engine components. And after it's absorbed that heat, it then eventually finds its way out to the radiator, where the atmosphere then absorbs the heat from the radiator. And that's why the radiator has those little fins, much like your cooling unit at your house on your heat pump. It's the same type of thing. It's trying to transfer heat from the engine away out to the atmosphere. Just like at home, you know, when you run your air conditioning, you're trying to transfer heat away from the inside of your house and let that heat go outside where it came from.
So it occurs to me now that we're talking about this, you need to have a lot of surface area to be able to dissipate all that heat. So, I mean, are we talking like hundreds of feet of tubing in your radiator or something?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's not hundreds of feet of tubing. It's probably, depends. It's, you know, I would say it could be 30 or 40 feet of tubing, but if you look at a radiator really closely, they have that really, really thin metal fins. Mm-hmm. And those fins are attached to each tube to essentially, you know, quadruple or even more the surface area.
More place for the heat to move off, yeah. Plus,
exactly.
Plus the fact they really hurt if you move your finger over them too fast.
They're very sharp. Yeah, they're very thin metal. And that's the whole point, is those things get hot because they absorb the heat from the tubes, which inside the tubes is the liquid. And then, you know, you have all that extra surface area, and air moves across that, and the heat is allowed to be released to the atmosphere.
What is the advantage of using ethylene glycol with water instead of just water for a coolant?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a lot of old-timer mechanics, let me say, like my grandpa was teaching me how to fix cars, which, you know, he didn't, but if he was, a lot of grandpas probably would have said, you don't need to use that coolant, you just use water. But the truth is the ethylene glycol serves many purposes. One is it increases the boiling point. So, you know, water boils at 212, and I think with ethylene glycol non-pressurized, the boiling point goes up to maybe 230. And then if you pressurize that, it goes up even more. So you don't want any boiling to occur in that system because, of course, then you'll get air bubbles, and that can impede the flow of the liquid. So it's not only is it a boiling point increaser, but it's also a rust inhibitor, so that inside the coolant jackets, which oftentimes are cast iron, there's rust that could build up if you didn't have a good quality concentrate or mixture of ethylene glycol. So there's the rust inhibitor, there's the boiling point, and then there's also the antifreeze. It keeps it from freezing. So instead of freezing at 32, it's going to freeze, you know, well below zero, depending on the amount of mixture. So if you have a 50-50 mixture, you're going to get a certain antifreeze. If you need more antifreeze characteristic, then you'd go heavier on the antifreeze or heavier on the ethylene glycol, to be technical. So you got those three things that are all really, really critical for your engine's longevity.
Zach Edwards is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange for this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. He's the proprietor of Ashland Automotive, and we're talking about cooling system issues with your car or truck. You can join the conversation, and it doesn't have to be just about coolant issues. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange in The Squeaky Wheel.
Howdy. A friend of mine has to add water to her cooling system once every week and a half, 2 weeks. I suggested that she just throw in some stop leak. She said she heard that that'll clog up your cooling system. I wonder how often you have to do that before it actually does clog up your system and, you know, just what the deal is with it.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. First of all, why would anybody need to add water to a cooling system? It's got to have a leak somewhere if that's happening, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The cooling system is a sealed system, so it should never become low. Once the level is correctly set and any air bubbles that were in the system from it once being opened up and repaired, for instance, once any of those air bubbles have been eliminated and the system has been bled, then the level will settle to a point where it shouldn't change until, it will increase with heat. So you can see your level go up and down in the reservoir depending on temperature. But the cold level should always stay the same and the hot level should generally stay the same. So if your friend, Steve, is having to add water, that would mean that her cooling system is leaking somewhere. And regarding stop leak, we never suggest anyone use stop leak. Now, stop leak can be a really handy thing if you're on the side of the road and you've got a problem and you need to get to a safe place. But stop leak can plug or restrict passageways.
Because it's meant to be gooey and close up holes. Right?
Yeah, it's a chemical reaction that happens in the presence of oxygen. So once it's mixed with a ethylene glycol mixture and then exposed to oxygen again, it hardens and crusts up, which is how it's supposed to just crust up at the leak. So when the leak is being introduced to the outside atmosphere, then it's supposed to become crusty and seal things up. But we've just seen so many times where it hardens and crusts up in other places too, which can cause major problems and hot spots to develop. Eventually a hot spot develops and that can cause a failure at that location in an engine.
Oh, so you got a point where things just aren't circulating, and that's the place where the heat is going to build up.
Exactly, and if that happens to be in a coolant jacket, then you get a big hot spot on the side of a cylinder, and then you melt a piston ring, for instance, or something.
I have to wonder about the people who developed, you know, figured out, we need something to keep this thing cool. You know, the people who developed internal combustion engines going, well, it worked great for about an hour, and then it died because it was really, really hot. So you have to wonder about that whole process. Let's take another call from Justin in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Justin.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello.
Go. What's gone? Tell us your issue. Go ahead, Justin.
I have a 1996 Ford Ranger. It's a four-cylinder, 2.3-liter engine. It runs really great, 115,000 miles original. It starts up just fine in the morning, and then when it's running, actually, at running temperature, the temperature sensor doesn't show it that it's in a hot range or anything, but it does take longer to start it. And sometimes it'll kind of start up and then it'll just die for a second and start right up. But my thought is it's a fuel issue, it's like fuel vapors, but I'm not 100% sure on what's causing this.
But when it starts up fine when it's just getting started for the day and it stays running until it gets hot?
Yeah, it starts, turns over, starts right up. When it gets up to running temperature, it seems to not kind of hesitate. And it takes longer to turn. It turns over probably 10 times, and then it'll start up. And sometimes it'll kind of start up, and it'll sound like it's dieseling or like a little low idle kind of before it actually fires up. But then and occasionally it will start up, and then it'll die.
Okay,
let's get up. But it hesitates to start after it's warmed up.
All right, let's give Zach a crack at this. Thanks for that, Justin.
Okay, well, so as with many things with cars, your symptom could be caused by multiple different problems. But since we're talking about cooling systems, I think we should talk about the cooling system things that could be causing the problem, because there is a cooling system temperature sensor, which is a pretty integral input used by the powertrain control module of a vehicle. And, you know, 96 Ford Ranger is certainly going to have a computer that's going to want to know the temperature of the coolant and also want to know the temperature outside and compare those two values so that it can give the correct amount of fuel to the air-fuel mixture. And so what can happen when a coolant temperature sensor begins to fail? They can, you know, one way they fail is they just fail completely and they just go totally offline and they're done. Another way they fail is they fail when they're cold, and then they start to work properly once they're heated up. But another way they can fail, which might be what's happening in your case, Justin, is they work fine when they're cold, and they fail under heat. And so what could be happening is that coolant temperature sensor could be giving the powertrain control module the correct temperature reading when it's cold out and everything starts fine, which is essentially like choking your lawnmower engine or choking, you know, an old choke. It's saying, hey, the coolant temperature's 43 degrees, the outside temperature's 43 degrees, and the computer is interpreting that as this is a cold start. So it enriches the air-fuel mixture. Then, as soon as possible, that engine is going to want to lean out that air-fuel mixture, and it's going to know to lean that out.
So more air, less gas.
Well, yeah, not more air, just less gas. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, essentially more air in the mixture because it can control the fuel more so than it can control the air. And so as soon as it can, it wants to do that. And how it does that is by looking at the coolant temperature sensor signal. And if your sensor is failing after it becomes heated up, then the car is going to not understand what mixture to give, and it's going to err on the side. Usually it will err on the side of running rich so that you can continue to drive. But you might interpret that as a driver as, you know, hesitation, or it could be difficult to start. You might see some black smoke out the tailpipe from a rich running condition. You might smell a little bit of raw fuel.
So 96 is fairly early in onboard diagnostic computers, isn't it? But it would still be able to tell. I mean, the sensors are there. So can the sensor diagnose when it's not working correctly?
Yeah, my guess is that you might have a code stored in the computer's memory. But 96, like you said, that's 22 years ago. That was the first year that the government mandated a universal plug, which is the data link connector. But again, our daily experience at the shop, we've seen countless numbers of coolant temperature sensors which fail and have no code stored in the memory. So it's called a no-code failure. And those are really difficult to diagnose. And that's where the technician just has to have a thorough understanding of what could possibly cause this customer's symptoms and then go in there and actually run some tests where, you know, he would or she would test that coolant temperature sensor under at a totally cold condition, and then test it again under a hot condition, and maybe a third test in you know, somewhere in the middle. And then we would generally be able to find a chart, a corresponding voltage drop or a corresponding resistance with the temperature that the sensor is submerged in. So there's other things that could cause that problem as well, and certainly a 96 Ford Ranger has other input that the computer is going to be looking at for fuel delivery. But we've seen a lot of coolant temperature sensor failures, especially on older cars. They sit there in 220 degree, you know, antifreeze.
They get cooked after
hour after hour, yeah. Day after day, and they give us, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles of service, and then one day they just give up and they're done.
Thanks for the question, Justin. Appreciate that. Best of luck with trying to figure out what's going on with your Ford Ranger. I had to ask about radiator cracks, because both of our vehicles in the last year have developed radiator cracks and had to be replaced. What's going to cause a radiator to quit over time?
It's just age-related failure. You know, there's the radiator.
Are you saying our cars are old?
Maybe.
Yeah, they're 20 years plus.
Yeah, you know, radiators, when they're assembled, they're the old copper core radiators had a tank that was soldered on to the core. And so where that seam was soldered, that was a common cause of failure. Nowadays, cars, because of weight limits and fuel economy standards, they're made of aluminum and they have a plastic tank. And that plastic tank is put onto the aluminum core and then crimped. And there's a seal inside there, and that seal can fail. And so, you know, when things get hot and cool back down, there's expansion and contraction. And, of course, engineers have taken all that into consideration. But eventually the day comes where things just fail. They can't last forever. And, you know, radiators definitely take a beating. They also take a lot of rocks.
Oh, that's
driving
true.
Down the road, you know, there's debris.
Bugs. Birds.
Bugs.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You name it. I was going to ask before we go about the water pump. I had a little luck once when I knew it was going out, because I could see the line of rusty water sprayed around the engine compartment. So it's okay, I think my water pump is quitting, and it was. But other than that, I mean, what do you know? Your sensor's going to tell you something?
No, but I can tell you that if you saw a line of rusty water around it, it's probably the fact that you didn't have coolant, a proper antifreeze mixture. Because that also serves
rusty water.
That also serves as a lubricant for rotating things such as a water pump. And so the fact that the 50% water and 50% ethylene glycol mixture had been allowed to turn into just rusty water probably contributed to that water pump failure. And I would also like to say, modern water pumps are now becoming electric. So there's a lot of cars using electric water pumps, so that the water pump doesn't actually have to pump when it's not needed, thus saving and increasing fuel economy and saving energy.
Oh, we haven't even talked about electric fans. Maybe that's something we can look at next month.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about cooling systems for a long time, and it's a lot of fun for me, so I'll look forward to it.
Okay, well, it'll still be summer next time we meet, so we'll take it up again in the new building. Zach Edwards here for the Squeaky Wheel once again. Always good to see you.
You too. Thanks.